I'm talking to Linda Grasso, and thanks for being on Women's Focus.
Thank you so much for having me.
One of the things that we think about with Georgia O'Keeffe in New Mexico, especially in terms of whether she was a feminist or not, what people say is that she gave money to Planned Parenthood and that she would pay for the girls in the town, that she would pay for them to have abortions.
Really?
Yeah. And
I've
so
never heard that.
And so people assumed that she was a feminist because of that.
Well, that's interesting. I've never heard that in all the materials that I've looked at. But one of the things I wanted to do in this book was get at this question of, was she or wasn't she a feminist? Because it becomes very difficult to answer that question. Do we determine whether someone is a feminist based on what they say about what they do, about what they do, what they do when, how? Do we determine whether someone is a feminist based on what others say they do? So in order to get at this question, what I am proposing in this book is to ask a different question. Instead of asking, was she or wasn't she a feminist, I'm using the concept of feminist practices, which women's historians have suggested as a way of rethinking this whole problem. And that is, the idea of feminist practices is, in what ways does a person advance justice for women?
Well, okay, that sort of brings me to another thought that I had, or a surprise that I had when I was... One of the things that your book brought up for me, because Georgia O'Keeffe's life went over such a long period, that there were two times of feminism, the early feminism and then the second wave, and that I thought that the early feminism was only involved with suffrage. And you bring out that no, there was actual, what we think of as feminism in other areas, and that was a whole separate movement, and
right.
That's something I just didn't know anything about.
Well, that's something I'm really devoted to doing in this book too, which is to think about feminism historically by using O'Keeffe as a kind of case study, a lens to really talk about the history of feminism, the long history of feminism, and I'm concentrating just on the United States. So feminism, when O'Keeffe was formed by it in the 1910s, was very much shaped by modernism, with this value on rupture, on newness, on really shaking things up. When O'Keeffe created herself as an artist, it was the flourishing of feminism, actually, internationally. And she was very much shaped by this movement. Many historians have talked about trying to untangle the different strands of the woman's movement. They called it the woman's movement at the time, which comes from the 19th century, and what happens in the 1910s. So I talk about this in the book. There are many, many things going on at once. It's really kind of the end point of the 19th century women's rights movement, and then there's a big push for suffrage, and at the same time, there is the development of modernism, and feminism emerges within modernism. So that all of these things are connected in terms of everybody's looking at women's rights, but there are different ways of thinking about it. And we think about feminism as distinguished from women's rights in terms of a kind of attitude.
And that's really kind of exciting, because when you begin the book and you talk about O'Keeffe being affected by these thoughts and what was happening at the time, I kept thinking, well, this isn't what I've heard about O'Keeffe. And then when you sort of explain it in the kind of second chapter, the second part of the book, that's when it sort of becomes a revelation that she was affected by feminism, but she also wanted to construct her own persona.
Well, One of the things I was able to do through the generosity of particularly one of O'Keefe's first serious heterosexual relationships with this guy, Arthur MacMahon, when I found his son, he generously sent me all of these unpublished letters that are still in his possession that O'Keefe wrote to his father. And what I discovered was, what I tried to do from these letters and also from the literature that I had, the secondary scholarship that I had read. So what I tried to do was to figure out what her influences were in this period. And I was able to do that through these letters that she had written Arthur MacMahon, through her relationship with Anita Politzer, also through letters, and then through her relationship with Stieglitz, also through the correspondence. And what I discovered was that she really was very much centrally involved in several different movements, change movements, modernist movements in New York City in the 1910s through her very close relationships with these three different people. Now, Anita Politzer, you know, we have correspondence published between Politzer and O'Keefe, was a very close friend that she met when she was at Teachers College, training to become an art teacher, and so was Anita Politzer. Anita then became very involved in the suffrage movement and ended up in the 1940s becoming a major figure in the National Woman's Party. So it was really through Anita that O'Keefe was connected to organized feminism in this early period. But she was also involved in, or she had knowledge of, reform movements and kind of feminist happenings through Arthur MacMahon, who was a graduate student at the time at Columbia, working with Charles Beard, who was married to Mary Beard, Mary Beard being a very important feminist thinker. He was involved in these social change movements through the university structure. He really believed that change could happen through education, through educational reform. But through him and his friends, O'Keefe had entree to Greenwich Village, radicalism, and then through Stieglitz, she also had connection to cultural radicalism in a very broad way. So all of these people are writing letters, they're all exchanging books, they're all talking about the books that they're reading, the art that they're seeing. And so I realized that she was really kind of in the thick of it at, you know, at this moment, and this really shaped her. She was reading Charlotte Perkins Gilman's feminist journal, which didn't last for very long, but is, it, you know, was a very important journal at the time. Gilman was a foremost feminist thinker at the time. She had seen Isadora Duncan dance. She wrote a letter to Stieglitz saying, "Once I had seen her, I couldn't stop myself from going back." She asked Stieglitz to find any information he can about Duncan and send it to her because she was giving a talk and she wanted this information. So all of these relationships and influences factored into how she created herself and how she thought about herself, and I argue in the book, really created openings for her to have, most importantly, to have the ambition to be an artist, a great artist, to see herself as perhaps contending with all of these male artists. She was incredibly driven, and I think that feminism in all its realms, within the academy, in the suffrage movement, in the artistic movements, in dance, in literature, all of these ideas helped her have a position and a platform and encouraged her to shape herself. And
yeah, but that's one of my point is that she decided, she seemed to want to negate what the influences were on her.
Later on.
So that was the part that was surprising to me.
Right. So, you know, the big mystery then is, and the irony is, why is it that somebody who was so shaped by feminism becomes a feminist icon as early as the 1920s? And she remained so, maybe in the period of the 50s, not so much anymore, because that was kind of a period of decline for her after Stieglitz's death. But looking through the literature, if you read the reviews in the 20s, in the 30s, and the 40s, she is upheld as a feminist icon. She speaks the language of what I call equal rights feminism in some interviews. She gives a couple of talks at National Woman's Party events. She goes to some conventions of the National Woman's Party. She wrote an article that appears in the National Woman's Party newsletter in the 1940s that I'm certain that she wrote herself. But she kind of keeps this bifurcated life and doesn't talk about being a member of the National Woman's Party publicly, which was so fascinating to me, why. And then, of course, in the 1970s, she disavows the next iteration of feminism so vehemently. So how do you explain that, right? That's the big question. So I conclude that I think the modernist aesthetic, which, if you remember, in the 1910s, feminism and modernism are integrally entwined. They share the same values, rupture from the past, leaving behind old traditions. It's all about new, making it new, being daring, courageous. And also individualism was a very big value within modernism. So she very much valued the idea of being an individual and having an individual take on that she as an individual had succeeded. And, she was self-made. What's interesting about O'Keeffe is that these tried and true notions about America, that we can make ourselves, we can remake ourselves, get mapped on to O'Keeffe's story, O'Keeffe's life story. So there's a beautiful melding there. She made of herself this great artist. So, she's in her 80s, right, in the 1970s. She's older. She's fought all these fights. She's struggled vehemently to create art over a lifetime, which in many different arenas, women have a difficult time sustaining a lifetime of artistic production or scholarly production, right? You hear of all these men who've written like 10, 15 books. How many women are in that category for a variety of reasons? So I think she very much wanted to script her own story, her own legacy in that period. And when the 1976 book comes out, right, it's, I think, a direct response to the feminist art movement and the women's movement at that time. And in that book, it's basically, I made myself. Mm-hmm. So I think she was very much, why was feminism so threatening to her? Her first biographer, Lori Lyle, asked me that recently. Why so threatened by feminism? Well, it must have really gone to the core of what she felt like she wanted the world to know about her by that time, and that was that she had done it, she had made it by herself. And then this gets complicated by the fact that, as scholars tell us all the time, that feminism is a contested concept, it's a contested word. And to be identified as a feminist is professionally risky. And that's going on even now. Why do certain people disavow the term? They don't want to be called feminists, because feminism is debated, you know, who gets to define what a feminist is. And so to be categorized in that way could be threatening mm-hmm. to her and the way she was perceiving what was going on at the time.
Okay, so essentially she was experiencing what we have now, where there are younger, especially younger
That's
women
right.
who are rebelling against the word feminism right. or being called feminist.
Yeah, but right now it's very interesting at this particular historical moment. I think there's more receptivity to the term. I mean, I just, in my neighborhood the other day, I saw a kid maybe 10 years old, you know, wearing the T-shirt that says feminist. So the question is, you know, how are these particular kids of certain generations, you know, how are they making meaning of what feminism was? What feminism is, right? What does that mean to them? I mean, O'Keeffe has been called a feminist by all these different people, but that's how I start the book. You know, when they call her a feminist, does feminist mean the same thing to each one of them, right? So what does feminism mean to them? So I think that, you know, other scholars have said this, and I think it's true, that she very much wanted to define her own terms, to define her own legacy. And she, I think, was equating feminism with this business of having a specifically female point of view, which was antithetical to the way she wanted to see herself at the end, which was as an American. You know, there's this whole thing about that she didn't like to be categorized, she didn't like isms, and she didn't like to be categorized, or she didn't like to be part of groups. But if you notice, she never had a problem but with being called an American artist, or her work being included in exhibitions that were about American art. So what makes being an American different from being a feminist artist?
I wanted to be sure to bring in some of the things she said about New Mexico and New Mexican women, because that was interesting. Towards the end, you had a saying that she, or of something that she had said, a quote from her, talking about the work that New Mexican women, how New Mexican women do work that's accepted along with men's building adobes.
Well, I think like other artists of her generation, she ennobled the idea of Native peoples, how they worked with their hands, and looked to Native peoples as being a model of kind of gender equality. So that was, I think you're referring to the 1948 article that appears in the National Woman's Party Journal, where she talks about how the women work alongside the men and that their work is valued, and that's what she doesn't see kind of happening in the rest of the country. Yeah. When I was talking before about her attitudes in the 70s and 80s about feminism, so the history of feminism is very complicated. After suffrage is won in 1920, the feminist movement then has to decide what it's going to be, what it's going to represent, what it's going to struggle for. And it's very hard for them to reach consensus. And that's how the idea of equal rights comes out, because that's the one thing that they seem to be able to agree upon. But then feminism itself fractures. There's a big debate over protective legislation that the National Woman's Party that O'Keeffe was affiliated in, they believed that there should not be any kind of special legislation based on gender, because they embraced the idea that men and women were more the same than they were different. Whereas the people involved in wanting to secure special legislation for women workers that was based on the idea that women were different from men. And this is what creates lots of schisms around the Equal Rights Amendment, which is what the National Women's Party is advocating and O'Keefe advocates. But this fractures the whole movement. And at the same time, the rise of the left in the 1930s begins to demonize feminism as being bourgeois and anti-labor. So it becomes very complicated. So, of course, O'Keefe lives through all of this. And she knows about the different ways in which feminism is regarded within all these different groups. So again, it's very treacherous to identify, for women to identify publicly as feminists. But I did find instances where she did advocate feminist causes, but then there's the issue of where she never talked about this publicly. In the interviews that she gave, she would talk a lot about how angry she was about being discriminated against as a woman, but she never talked about these affiliations with feminist institutions or feminist causes, which I found absolutely fascinating. Mm-hmm. So it was this kind of bifurcated existence, and it was kind of like trying to figure out, I mean, I combed and combed the archives, trying to figure out what she actually did do and how to characterize what she did and why she remained silent about it. She basically erased, I think, that history from her life story, and that's the story that we inherit.
Mm-hmm. Talk about her answers when she was criticized for painting, that her painting was too sexual.
Well, the thing that's repeated all the time that she said is that, you know, you're talking about yourself, you're not talking about me. That was so difficult for her, because what I sort of understand about all of this is that, again, to go back to the importance of modernism, in the modernist period, men were, you know, having a heyday using sexuality or painting sexuality or thinking about sexuality through their art. And I think O'Keefe was very ambitious, and she wanted to do the same thing. She wanted to play like the boys. And she wanted to experiment. She wanted to do all of these things, and they could do it, and she couldn't. So then she's in this bind because she gets accused of being nothing but sexual. And that generated, I think, a lot of anger. You know, don't pigeonhole me. Don't. And then to make it worse, it was personalized, right, through Stieglitz's role and her involvement with Stieglitz, which is another irony, is that she's touted as being the anomalous woman artist, but so many of her experiences are so common to successful career women. And the other irony that I wanted to say previously is that here we have Georgia O'Keeffe as the feminist icon, but she's a feminist icon who's disconnected from any kind of feminist movement. And that is really interesting to me, that people don't know her history. Barbara Lyons has talked about her involvement with the National Woman's Party, but what I discovered is that it went a little bit further. And for all those graduate students listening who need dissertation topics, what was going on in New Mexico in relation to the National Woman's Party in the 1950s would be a fascinating project. There weren't that many women involved because they didn't have enough numbers to qualify to vote at the convention. They were a little bit short, but Maria Chabot is listed as being an officer of the New Mexico branch. O'Keefe is listed as being an officer in the New Mexico branch. Did they do anything? They might have been just figureheads, but what did they do? And who were the other women involved? There's a photograph that was taken. I'm not even sure where it was taken. I thought maybe it was O'Keefe's house, of a group of women with Anita Politzer. in the 40s. Who are those women? You know, what was going on?
Oh, okay.
Well, right?
Okay, so there's a challenge to go on.
Talk about, you know, what I wanted people to get out of this book is just what I really want people to get out of this book is thinking about feminism historically. And that in order to understand whether or not somebody is a feminist, you need to understand what feminism means in that particular historical moment to that particular person, what community that person is in, and what they were doing and how they were doing it. Okay. That's really what I'm trying to do here. And to, as I call one of the chapters, to put women back into the picture. And I really believe that it was the ideas of feminism that enabled O'Keeffe to become the O'Keeffe that we know today. And all the women, some of whom are the names we know and many of them that we don't, who really helped O'Keeffe achieve the success that she enjoys still to this day, including all of the women who wrote to her and whose letters are archived in those boxes of fan mail in her archive, all of those women, because one could imagine getting all of those letters. O'Keeffe complains about them at a certain point, but given the kinds of struggles that she had to go through to achieve her career, the personal struggles, the political struggles, to get that kind of those letters full of awe and admiration and recognition of what she's done must have made her feel good and encouraged her to keep going on and on and on. I mean, who wouldn't want to get letters like that?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.